hppodcraft.com.
The following was recorded at the Necronomicon, live from the Biltmore Hotel in Providence, Rhode Island, on August 18, 2017.
Along the Massachusetts coast where he lived, many things are whispered about Enoch Conger, and certain others are hinted at in lowered voices and with great caution. Things of surpassing strangeness which flow up and down the coast in the words of seafarers from the port of Innsmouth, for he lived only a few miles down the coast from that town, at Falcon Point, which was so named because it was possible to see the peregrines and merlins, and even sometimes the great gerfalcons at migration time passing by this lonely finger of land jutting into the sea. There he lived until he was seen no more, for none can say he died.
For all we know, he didn't die.
That was a very ominous opening to a very special show. A show that we're recording in the hometown of H.P. Lovecraft during the 2017 Necronomicon. A show that we like to call the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Live in Providence.
Yay!
Thank you so much, folks, for coming out today. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am Chris Lackey.
We are, of course, on your internet dial at hppodcraft.com. Physically, we are recording from the historic Providence Biltmore in the Garden Room, where big band legends Benny Goodman and Jimmy Dorsey once played. And reportedly, a ghost was murdered here in 2005. So the ghost of that ghost is with us. And he's not the only one.
With us today, and at every single one of our live shows, is the amazing, the talented, the lustrious Andrew Lehman.
Lustrious, ooh.
Hi.
He's the man. Thank you so much for helping us out once again, Andrew. You can, of course, see Andrew performing all over the con. Tonight, we will all be in the same room, doing a live version of The Brotherhood of the Beast. We are also privileged to have our music provided today by Lyle Erickson. Woo! Lyle's been with us at our last two Providence shows. He's an amazing guy who I have rocked with for many years, and he is also the man behind the band The Spider Translator. You can check them out at spidertranslator.com. Extra creepy music that you've heard on the show and you will hear again today when we're closing up. You'll hear some sweet beats from Lyle over there. They won't be sweet beats? No, okay, they'll be sweet.
Chad, it is so good to be back here in Providence. This is a great town. It's got so much to offer, and this convention offers even more than just Providence itself.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get enough of it.
I can't get enough of it either. And you know what else I can't get enough of? Fedogen and Bremmer, yeah. Weird fiction publishers extraordinaire.
Gear it up for Fedogen and Bremmer.
I feel the same way. We are lucky to have Fedogen and Bremmer with us.
Well, last time we talked about their excellent audio CD of The Fungi from Yuggoth, which is still excellent. This time I'd like to tell you about some of the books they have on offer. Their latest hardcover release is Earth, Air, Fire, and Water, Four Elemental Mythos Tales by Brian Lumley. Brian stayed true to August Derleth's suggestion that the mythos monsters could be viewed as elemental avatars. This collection spans from 50 years ago to yesterday, showcasing Lumley's long, long writing history of good old pulpy mythos stories up to a new novel-length story presented here for the first time. It has a Bob Eggleton dust jacket, also interior illustrations by Jim Pitts. Fedogen and Bremmer are also bringing back their long out-of-print collections by the Wandry brothers, Donald and Howard, as trade paperbacks. What do we have there?
We have Time Burial, which is a collection of Howard Wandry's pulp horrors illustrated with his very own artwork. There is also Don't Dream, which collects Donald Wandry's fantasy and horror short stories.
Donald was, of course, a co-founder of Arkham House and was considered the logical successor to Lovecraft in 1937. However, World War II, unfortunately, pretty much ended his writing career. We haven't covered him on the show yet, but this book, Don't Dream, is definitely one that we're going to want to snap up. We do have this other paperback reprint.
Yes, it's a reprint of Dead Titans Waken. This includes both Donald's novels. It was previously only available as a very pricey limited edition book. Donald talked about these novels in correspondence with Lovecraft. The second novel is this collection, Invisible Sun. Wasn't published until almost 30 years after the author died because it was a bit too explicit for publishers in 1933.
Right, but not too explicit for Fedogen and Bremmer books. These guys aren't scared of anything. But you will be scared after you buy their books and read them, and that's how most of us here like to spend our time. Let's be honest, that's why we're at this convention. Mm-hmm. So please go to visit Fedogen and Bremmer in the vendor hall, and if you come up here afterwards, I think these books that are on display, they'll happily sell you. Now, I mentioned August Derleth a moment ago, and I'm mentioning him again now because that's what you call a segue.
Yes, it is. Since it's August, we felt that we would be remiss if we did not cover an August derelict story, because, as you know, August is for August.
It's the easiest thing in the world.
It's the easiest thing to remember. While nothing can compare with the Dark Brotherhood and his seven deadly pose, these two are not bad. Yeah. You know, there's some humorous bits to them.
There are. We're covering The Fisherman at Falcon Point and The Shadow in the Attic today. And I will admit, I initially said, let's do some August derelict because I like to laugh. And like you say, there's some of that in here. But I also thought these stories were interesting because they're more than typical Lovecraft ripoffs. Both of them concern relationships and have strong female characters. What? Now, I read both of these stories in The Watchers Out of Time. And if you remember, that book is credited to H.P. Lovecraft with August derelict. These are the posthumous collaborations in which Derleth would take some idea of Lovecraft's, expand it into a story, then slap Lovecraft's name on it to sell books. So the first story we're covering today, we heard Andrew read the first paragraph at the top. It's called The Fisherman at Falcon Point, and this story was first published in the Arkham House volume The Shuttered Room and Other Pieces in 1959. It is based on this entry from Lovecraft's commonplace book. Fisherman casts his net into the sea by moonlight, what he finds. So that is the sum of what Lovecraft contributed to the story with his name on it. The rest is Derleth. And that's how it works.
You know, I'm going to start doing collaborations with Lovecraft.
You should?
I mean, if Derleth can just pick not even a complete sentence.
What do you think the fisherman found when he...
I think the fisherman found $1 million.
There you go. You just collaborated.
I've collaborated with Lovecraft.
Anybody else? What do you think the fisherman might have found?
Yeah, what did the fisherman...
What do you think? Anybody?
Anybody. You. What did the fisherman find?
Fish. Just collaborated with Lovecraft.
The ghost of a ghost.
Congratulations.
The ghost of a ghost.
Everybody can collaborate.
H.P. Lovecraft with Andrew Lehman.
There you go. But let's see what Derleth did with this fertile nuggets.
With his what?
Verbal nugget. Okay, this
I said fertile.
Oh, fertile. I thought you said verbal nugget.
No.
Either way, it's disturbing.
So the story starts off with a legend, or a rumor, really, of this fisherman. His name's Enoch Conger. He lived on the coast from Innsmouth in a place called Falcon Point. Yeah.
This was, of course, later renamed to Falcon Crest in the 80s. Very proud of that.
So you're trying to say that Falcon Crest is an adaptation of this story?
I'm suggesting it. Yeah.
It's a collaboration with Lovecraft.
It's a collaboration, that's right.
Yeah. Enoch is gone now, and none can say what happened to him. Anyway, Derelict goes into description of this beefy fisherman.
Yeah. Andrew?
He was a powerful man, broad in the shoulders, barrel-chested, with long, muscular arms. Even in middle age, he wore a beard, and long hair crowned his head. His eyes were a cold blue in color and set deep in his square face, and when he was clad in rainproof garments with a hat to match, he looked like someone who had stepped from an old schooner a century ago.
Or from Brooklyn 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. Enoch lived alone in a little shack he made for himself out there on Falcon Point, and he spent his days fishing. People said that he could talk to the gulls and the birds, and that he could talk to things that others could not see.
Yeah, nothing too weird. He just happens to be very in touch with nature.
Now, he would sell his fish up and down the coast at Innsmouth and Kingsport, which made him just enough money to get by. There was this tavern on the outskirts of Innsmouth that he would frequent, often drinking alone. But one day, he came into the tavern with this look of shock on his face, and he sat down and drank. Now, the regulars, they wanted to know what was up, so they started buying him drinks, kind of getting him in the mood to tell his story.
As you do.
He said he had seen a great wonder that night. He had brought his boat up to Devil Reef more than a mile outside Innsmouth and cast his net and brought up many fishes and something more. Something that was a woman, yet not a woman. Something that spoke to him like a human being, but with the gutturals of a frog speaking to the accompaniment of fluting music, such as that piped from the swamps in the spring months. Something that had a wide slash of a mouth, but soft eyes. And that wore, beneath the long hair that trailed from her head, slits that were like gills. Something that begged and pleaded for its life and promised him his own life, if ever the need came upon him.
Holy cow, a sexy deep one?
No.
I didn't know those existed.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that you just called her sexy deep one speaks to how starved weird fiction readers are for female characters. Yeah. Because if you look at that description, what are you finding sexy exactly? Yeah. Is it the voice which sounds like the gutturals of a frog speaking to the accompaniments of fluting music, or is it the wide slash of a mouth?
Or the slits that she wears. Like, can she the take them off?
It's the soft eyes.
Oh, the soft eyes.
Well, her obviously. Eyes are, yeah, but her eyes are described as soft, which may mean she has some kind of internal tenderness that reads through them, but I actually think he means they're soft, like if you touch them, your finger will go in like it's through some jello or something like that.
No.
Nevertheless, this is a sexy deep one we're dealing with, and she tells Enoch that if he lets her go, she said to him she'd give him his own life in return if he someday needed it. And this is what he imparts.
When would he not need it, is my question.
Yeah, I know. When are you not going to cash that in?
Yeah.
But this is what he says to the guys at the pub.
No, yeah, he told the guys at the pub that, and then their response was, it's a mermaid. And then Enoch goes, no, it had legs. Mermaids don't have legs. You're not listening to me. It said she had legs, though her toes were webbed. She had hands, though her fingers were webbed. And the skin on her face was like that of mine, but her body wore the color of the sea. Now, this doesn't really sound like a deep one, but I guess Derleth is kind of just doing a bit of a riff here.
The whole story's a riff, so why not?
Enoch goes on to tell us that he held the creature caught in the net in his arms, describing the feeling of her cold skin and the texture of her body, telling of how he had set her free and watched her swim away and dive out of sight off the dark mound of Devil Reef, only to reappear and raise her arms aloft to him and vanish forever.
Is it the cold skin that you find sexy?
I don't find that attractive, but it seems to me that she's giving Enoch a bit of a trouser tent, you know? That's what it seems like.
Guys, this is going to be a juvenile show today.
I'm going to tell you.
Just preparing you for that.
It's Fedogen and Bremer's fault. Nothing's too explicit for them.
That's right. They're not afraid of it.
They're afraid of nothing. So the guys in the pub, obviously, they're teasing Enoch about this, and because they tease him, he goes to the pub less and less.
They asked him if he proposed to the mermaid before he set her free, but Enoch actually seemed kind of scared about what happened. He had caught her up at Devil Reef, and he won't fish around there anymore. He sticks to Falcon Crest. But by the way, what is the era of this story? Because it has to be before 1928, right?
I was thinking about that, and to me, this story doesn't make any sense unless... Unless the events of the Shadow over Innsmouth never happened. Because Innsmouth has been under the control of the Deep One since like the mid-1830s.
Yes. Yeah.
And if this story happens any time between then and, say, 1928, then Innsmouth guys know what a Deep One is. They know what a mermaid is. And I don't think they joke about either of those things.
Yeah, no.
But if it's after 1928...
The military raided Devil Reef and blew it up, right?
I don't know when in the hell this story takes place, but I think it takes place outside the Lovecraftian Innsmouth timeline.
Right.
Because otherwise it doesn't make a lick of sense to me.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think in the end this is just sort of a mythos version of the fisherman and his wife, but without the wishes. I think it's kind of cool to apply mythos tropes to a traditional fairy tale, and I think that's why he might be bending the rules in terms of what a Deep One looks like. Etc.
I think that he just read the story once.
I'm not sure he read it
Shadow
at all.
Shadow over Innsmouth. It was like, oh yeah, there was some thing in a town. People fished there. I'll write that in there.
Good enough.
Now, a few years go by and nobody really hears much about Enoch. This is until some fishermen find him on his boat and he's badly hurt. They take him back to his home at Falcon Point. I almost said Falcon Crest.
Good. Okay.
And not because there was help there, but because he insisted upon being taken back there. After they drop him off, they go into Innsmouth and get Dr. Gilman. When they return, Enoch is gone, and something strange has happened.
Mm-hmm.
They had found in the house a great moisture, a wetness clinging to the walls, to the doorknob, even to the bed to which they had lowered Enoch Conger only a short while before hastening for the doctor. And on the floor, a line of wet footprints made by feet with webbed toes, a trail that led out of the house and down to the edge of the sea. And all along the way, the imprints were deep, as if something heavy had been carried from the house, something as heavy as Enoch.
Mm. So people scoffed about this, but Dr. Gilman knew about the webbed feet of the people of Innsmouth.
I would hope so, since he's Dr. Gilman.
Yeah.
He would have impression of what that is.
Whatever happened to Enoch, he never returned to Falcon Point.
Along the coasts, the whispers died away and certain dark hints took their place, displacing the suspicions of murder and some deed of darkness with something fraught with even greater wonder and terror.
His house slowly fell apart over the years, but the tale is not yet over. Old Jedediah Harper, patriarch of the Harper family, comes to shore one day with his own tale. While out fishing on Devil's Reef, he saw 20 of these things. He says they were half man, half frog, and one of them he could have sworn looked just like Enoch Conger. As they swam, they chanted to Dagon and then descended into the depths.
Which, it's such a specific thing. I mean, if the guy says, I saw 20 of these things. Oh, what did they sound like? Well, they kind of sounded like they were chanting to Dagon. Like a chant of praise. I could be mistaken by that, but it was just, that's what it seemed like. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But there's this whole school of deep ones, and it looks like Enoch is with them.
After Jedediah's story gets out, the Marshes and the Martins of Innsmouth give old Harper a heap of money to stop fishing, as in, like, don't be a fisherman anymore, retire. And he does so with his crew as well. So there's obviously a cover-up, which makes me think this is before the Shadow of Innsmouth.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. No, I don't know.
Who knows? And as our
cracked it.
And as our story concludes, it's got a kind of a creepy ending.
Yeah. Long after, on another moonlit night, a young man who remembered Enoch Conger from his boyhood years in Innsmouth returned to that port city and told how he had been out with his young son rowing past Falcon Point in the moonlight, when suddenly, out of the sea beyond him, rose upward to his waist a naked man, so close to him he might almost have touched him with an oar, a man who stood in that water as if held aloft by others, who saw him not, but only looked toward the ruins of the house on Falcon Point with great longing in his eyes, a man who wore the face of Enoch Conger. The water ran down his long hair and beard and glistened on his body and was dark where beneath his ears he appeared to wear long slits in his skin. And then, as suddenly and strangely as he had come, he sank away again. And that is why, along the Massachusetts coast near Innsmouth, many things are whispered about Enoch Conger, and certain others are hinted at in lowered voices.
What the hell? Why was Enoch Conger out of the water, naked, in front of a kid?
Well, there's that.
Like, what's the point? What is the point of that? What was he trying to accomplish?
Well, since he only ever appears, you know, he never goes any higher than that. So he's really just a dude with a shirt off. We don't really know that he's naked.
Yeah, okay,
all
but
the way.
To that too, what is going on? Are the deep ones, like, they're lifting him up? So this is like some elaborate deep one plot to expose a dude to some kid?
Well,
yeah. That is the true
their goals
of this.
Ever since the raid, their goals have changed somewhat, apparently.
They have some kind of underwater cheerleader pyramid formation scheme that's, like, designed explicitly to flash sailors. That is the true...
They're trying out for America's Got Talent.
But, well... My question is, how did Enoch become a deep one? Because I thought this was like a genetic...
Well, but is he? Apparently he still has a full-length beard and hair, and, you know, he's not gone through... And he's wearing slits like they're removable. I don't... That's
weird. So this is kind of like how Splash ended, actually. If you're familiar with that movie. Because if you recall, Tom Hanks in that movie goes underwater with Daryl Hannah, and, like, they live out their life in some kind of undersea kingdom, so...
So now you're saying that this story was... adapted into the film Splash.
Both Falcon Crest and Splash were adapted from this story.
Well, I guess let's put that thing to bed.
Okay.
Let's get into our second tale, The Shadow in the Attic.
Great.
My great-uncle Uriah Garrison was not a man to cross. A dark-faced, shaggy-browed man with wild black hair and a face that haunted my childhood dreams. I knew him only in those early years. My father crossed him, and he died, strangely smothered in his bed 100 miles from Arkham, where my great-uncle lived. My Aunt Sophia condemned him, and she died, tripped on a stair by nothing visible. How many others might there have been? Who knows? Who could do more than whisper fearfully of what dark powers were at Uriah Garrison's command?
Looks like we got ourselves a creepy wizard uncle story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's murdered some people, even though he wasn't present when the deaths happened. And I like that his aunt was tripped on a stair by nothing visible. And that's described as really odd. But that happens to me several times a week. Where I'll just trip. There's nothing there. I don't know why I tripped. And it actually happened to me yesterday where I was walking with a, I don't know if this ever happened to you, where you're like, I was walking with a coffee and I tripped. So then you kind of start running so that you don't drop the thing. And it just looks like, anybody who's around, it looks like you just took off like a greyhound. And you're like, ah! But it's commonplace. It's not that odd is what I mean.
Do you have a wizard uncle who's cursing you from afar?
I got two of them. That possibly could be.
Yeah, okay.
Why that's happening.
As we get into the story, the wizard has died and left his house to his grandnephew, Adam Duncan. The house is in Arkham on the outskirts of town. It used to be outside of town, but Arkham being the sprawling metropolis that it is, it has grown and the house is now in town, much to the chagrin of his uncle Uriah.
Right, who wanted to kind of keep things private. Adam hasn't been there since he was a kid, but he does have memories of the place.
I never forgot the shadowed house where he lived alone and had someone in by night to keep his house for him. The high-ceilinged rooms, the shunned attic, which no one entered by day, and into which no one was permitted ever to go with a lamp or light of any kind. And one memorable night I lost my way and came upon my great-uncle's housekeeper, with her strange, emotionless, expressionless face. She stared at me and I at her, as across unfathomable gulfs of space. Before I turned and sped away, spurred by new fear imposed upon those engendered in dreams.
So Adam says he didn't really know his uncle. He didn't see him very much, a little bit when he was a kid. But his only real contact with him was he would send him Christmas and birthday cards, usually ones he just got at a charity shop.
After his father's death, the family just didn't want him to talk to the crazy uncle. And the crazy uncle never responded to his Christmas cards. So there's been no relationship other than the one from his childhood memories.
So Adam is totally surprised when he gets word that he is the one to inherit his house.
And if you've listened to our show, you know an inheritance never goes wrong. Yeah. If you inherit something, it's always going to turn out happily. There was another sentence in these paragraphs that made me laugh. This is like classic Derleth. Arkham held no particular attraction for me, though I was fascinated by the legends that haunted it. What? Like, if you're fascinated by the legends, that is a particular attraction. I don't understand that sentence.
The deal for him to inherit the property is that he had to live in the house for 3 months.
Yeah, and then after that three-month period, he can do whatever he wants with it, which is a really odd deal, you would think. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what he thinks. And he's going to do this over the summer when he's not in school, because Adam works at a university. He is a professor, but he's also, he's not a professor yet, he's a teacher.
He's like an English and literature student.
Yes,
and he's working
on his doctoral thesis.
There you go.
Adam's mom did not want him to do this because she really believed that Uriah was an evil wizard. But hey, it's valuable property in Arkham, and Adam and his fiancée, if they got this house, they would be set for life.
Yeah, they're just going to knock the property down and sell the land.
So he arrives in June of 1928, and the place is spotless, though it hadn't been lived in for 3 months. And he thinks, oh wait, that crazy, creepy housekeeper that he had must still be keeping the place clean. So he calls a realtor and asks, but he doesn't know anything about any housekeeper. And furthermore, the key that he gave him is supposed to be the only key that they have.
So she loves housekeeping so much that she's breaking in at night and cleaning the house. Perfectly reasonable.
Adam asks the realtor about his uncle, and he tells him that the neighbors didn't like him much, and it sounds like the realtor didn't actually like him very much either. He said he was a lusty, vigorous old fellow, very tough actually. But as so often happens, when his decline came, it came fast, and he was dead in just 1 week. Senility, the doctor said.
Yeah, and the realtor goes on to say, it's not like folks didn't always think Uriah was odd in the head before the senility struck. Apparently, he was into some very strange areas of research.
Yeah, it seems Uncle Uriah was really into the Salem witch trials and did a lot of studying on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered why the witch trials are used so much in these supernatural stories, because they weren't really witches. They were these people that were persecuted and being accused of witches. And the
you say.
Well, and the things that they did were like, I had a boil on my neck, and it's her fault.
You
it's
made
like,
my cow cry.
Like, if they were really witches, they should be able to, you know, stop people from killing them, you know, hanging them and things like that. So there's, right. They don't have any real power. So using them as antagonists seems like kind of lame to me.
They're used in fiction for the same reason they actually happened, because the idea of witchcraft is spooky and fun, and yeah. You can always claim that, you know, the trials didn't really get to the truth of it, and there was still real witches underneath, even though the right. People who got executed were...
They were patsies?
Yeah, patsies. The real witches set them up.
And I think the implication here is that the uncle has some next-level witchy literature.
Yeah.
He's got the real stuff that they wrote down with the spells and the whatnots. Kind of thing you might find from a fine publisher like Fedogen and Bremer. For example. Anyway, Adam moves into the house.
The house is well kept, as I said, and it has nice furniture. Adam plans to take some of the furniture for himself and then just sell the house. The thing is, the house is so old that it doesn't have any electricity, and the plumbing it just sucks. But the location is great, and of course, location, location, location.
That's right.
So someone should pay big bucks for this place.
He wires his fiance, and he says, "Hey, I'm all settled in. You should come by," and that gets us into chapter two.
Now, we learn about Adam's fiance, Rhoda.
Rhoda.
Like... You know, Rhoda's that's a name that doesn't come up very often except for Mary Tyler Moore and the spin-off show from Mary Tyler Moore, Rhoda.
I'm a millennial, so I don't know what any of that is. Totally lost on me.
You know what Falcon Crest is. How can you be a millennial?
Busted.
No, they
busted.
It's really popular on Instagrams and... On Snapchatters and stuff, is how everybody's talking Falcon Crest. So, you know, it's like retro stuff that old people used to watch with their moms. But I don't know about this Mary Todd Lincoln show you're talking about. I'm like 20.
So, Rhoda, of course, gets a physical description.
Yeah, let's hear about Rhoda.
Oh, yes. There she stood, with her shoulder-length ash-blonde hair damp with raindrops, and her thin lips parted, and her candid blue eyes taking in what she could see of the house with lively curiosity.
So she seems to like the place at first, but when he grabs her to give her a hug, this tremor seems to run through her body.
She can't understand how Adam can stand being in this place at all, let alone 3 months. And he's like, it's cool. It's a bit dark and old, but it's quiet, and I can get my work done here. And there's this little exchange. What was wrong with this place is dead. That was my great uncle. When he was here, I admit the house reeked of evil.
And it still does.
If you believe in psychic residue. he gets her to go to a restaurant and have dinner with him. But now, is she psychically sensitive? Or is the place totally evil and any person would sense it, but something's going on with him? That's what we don't quite understand at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, he thinks that she's a silly little goose, but he does sense that something's going on in the house. He says, I was aware from the moment of my fiancé's arrival of a kind of heightened awareness in the house, as if it apprehended some danger to itself. I have thought afterward that Rhoda's appearance on the scene hastened the happenings that were bound to take place in any event, but which would, in the normal course of circumstances, have taken place more insidiously. So Rhoda's appearance is sort of a catalyst for what's about to happen, partially because she's his fiancé, and it seems like the house wants him to itself in some way, and is jealous of her, but I think she's also a threat because she's smart, and it says in the story she's an instructor in philology and archaeology. And I know what one of those is. Clearly, she's an accomplished woman and a threat to the supernatural.
I think
force.
That's what happened on Mary Tyler Moore, too. That show would have been much more insidious if it hadn't been for Rhoda.
Bringing it together. So they go back to the house where they are spending the night, but they sleep in separate rooms because they're only engaged, even though later he does offhand mention that they've slept together. So
offhandedly,
I don't know what that's about.
We'll get to that. We will get to that.
Yeah. But I'm like excited thinking about it, but he's staying up in the uncle's bedroom right now and she's below in the guest room.
Yeah, he goes to bed and is awakened at midnight.
I lay for a few seconds growing to full wakefulness. What was it that had awakened me? A sound of breathing not my own? A nearby presence? Something on my bed? Or
all these things together. I thrust forth a hand and encountered, unmistakably, a woman's naked breast. And at the same moment, I was aware of her hot, fervid breath. And then, instantaneously, she was gone. The bed lightened. I felt, rather than heard, her movement toward the door of the bedroom. Fully awake now, I thrust back the light sheet covering me, for the night was sultry and humid, and got out of bed. With hands that trembled a little, I lit the lamp and stood there, undecided as to what to do. I was clad only in my shorts, and the experience had unsettled me more than I cared to say.
Yeah.
Woo. Now that's a classic, I have to say. The awkward reach to shake a hand or to take something from somebody, and then when you reach to grab it, you touch a boob. Oh, exactly.
It happens.
It's awkward. It's embarrassing for you. It's embarrassing for the woman.
Sometimes you trip and then just grab a boob.
You know, it's
always awkward.
It's not good. It's bad. Now imagine, if you would, if you accidentally touch a ghost's boob. You're not just embarrassed, you're horrified.
Yeah.
Stop it! That's somehow very sad.
But seriously, what the hell is this doing in this story?
I'm gonna have a heart attack. Yeah. Well, honestly, this is the most important part of the story, and you'll see why in the next section.
I am ashamed to admit that I thought at first it had been Rhoda, which was only evidence of the mental confusion the incident had brought me to, for Rhoda was incapable of such an act. Had she wished to spend the night in my bed, she would have said as much. She had done so before this. Further, the breast I had touched was not Rhoda's. Her breasts were firm, beautifully rounded. And the breast of the woman who lay next to me on my bed was flaccid, large, nippled, and old. And the effect of it, unlike Rhoda's, was one of shuddering horror.
So,
what have you guys gotten me into?
When I was highlighting it, I can't wait till Lehman reads this. Cannot wait. I just hearing it that time, actually, and the effect of it, unlike Rhoda's, was one of shuddering horror, as if you would assume.
Yeah, way to go, Rhoda.
Yeah.
But that was just a whole paragraph in this weird story about touching breasts.
Yeah.
Why? You don't need a whole paragraph.
And I was this thinking, a Lovecraft collaboration?
Yes, it is a Lovecraft.
Well, there you go.
If you just picked up the Watchers out of time, you would think that H.P. Lovecraft wrote this.
That was one of the lines in his commonplace book, right? Man gropes breasts.
What he finds.
What he finds.
But you just have to remember that this is a derelict story.
So
this is the man who brought us the seven deadly posts, and it all kind of makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, but yeah. So this is a succubus story. I think that what he's doing here, he wants to impress on the reader that this is a ghoul of some kind of sexual nature, and that it's a woman. So see, stop laughing, guys. But as a plot technique, I think the boob switcheroo is not a great... A great way to do this, because it made me laugh, and it's also his like unironic horror. You know, the breast was old instead of young. Like,
yeah.
It's also, as you said, it's hilarious that, by the way, I totally slept with Rhoda. You know, in that. And I think in the writer's mind, he was like, okay, she's a fiance because I want them in separate rooms. Now I'm going to do the boob switcheroo. No. How would he know that it's? Okay, he slept with his fiancée, but she's the one that says that they can do it, so that's why they didn't do it tonight. Perfect, it totally works out. I can use my technique.
So he gets out of bed, and he can't find anybody in the house. He hears a wailing scream of a woman's voice, but it fades away, all like a dream.
It says the wailing and screaming of a woman being punished, which I found odd, high up over the house like she's flying off into the air or something.
So after that, he goes back to bed, and in the morning, Rhoda strides into the kitchen and says, "There was a woman in the house last night." To his response is, "That it wasn't a dream." And Rhoda is pissed because, like, she thinks maybe he's two-timing her or something. I don't know, but Eventually, he seems to be able to convince her that he's actually as surprised as she is that there's somebody else in the house.
Yeah, and I think she's heard this legend that there's a cleaning woman who breaks in at night and straightens up the place. And it's funny because then, and they don't even get into where she was or what was going on, but she says, I know there was a woman here because I saw her. So she actually did physically see this woman.
Yeah. He asks her what she looked like, and she says, she seemed to be a young woman, but I had a strange feeling that she wasn't young at all. Her face was expressionless, fixed. Only her eyes seemed to be alive. Mm. Not unlike the Swami Chandraputra, if we want to recall another story. Mm-hmm. She's an old woman wearing a young woman's mask?
I think it's a mask. It's kind of like an eyes without a face look. I like it.
Adam still thinks that it's his great uncle's cleaning woman, but if that's his response to that, then that just kind of makes more questions than answers. You know, it's like, who's paying her to do this?
Right.
How does she get in the house? Does she live in the house? If she lives in the house, where is she living? So Rhoda accuses him of hiring somebody. Then he says, why would I hire somebody to clean? I wouldn't do that. And she goes, oh, of course you wouldn't. You're obviously lazy. She says, I believe it. You wouldn't lift a finger to dust even if you were drowning in it.
Zing! Why is she marrying this slob, you know? She could have any man at this convention, and she's stuck. Stuck with this bozo.
Heavy-handedly, Rhoda asks Adam if he can feel the strange feeling, almost like the house wants him. And she begs him to forget the inheritance, just leave with her. He thinks that she's being foolish and that he's going to stay no matter what.
It would be folly to surrender a valuable property we can both turn to good use simply to satisfy your whim, Rhoda. So he's being an idiot. She's the one that knows what's going on. One might say she's no boob.
Chapter 3. When his uncle was around, the attic was off limits. On the second day, he starts thinking about, oh yeah, I haven't been up in that attic yet, and so he's going to investigate. The attic door is open. In there, the attic is totally empty except for a chair in the middle of the room, and on the chair is a woman's dress, not unlike that of a housekeeper, and a rubber mask.
Which, I have to admit, that is a pretty creepy image if you open the attic and those were the only things in there.
Yeah. The rubber mask is, it doesn't ever describe what it looks like. Obviously, I think the assumption is that it looks like a young woman, but...
In my head, of course, it's William Shatner because of Halloween. But it says the mask was not at all hardening, betokening long disuse. It had the softness and flexibility of rubber that is being used, which was all the more mystifying. So... This is a mask someone's putting on, is the implication.
But he doesn't touch any of that stuff because it weirds him out a little bit. But in the corner of the attic, there is a scorch mark that is vaguely in the shape of a human form.
Mm-hmm. And on the opposite side of the room is a little hole in the wall near the floor, and it has marks painted around it. Can we get a description of those marks?
A sequence of curious angular lines, which seemed to me completely unlike any geometrical designs with which I was familiar, and which were arranged in such a fashion as to make the mouse hole seem their precise center. I thought instantly of my great-uncle's absorption in witchcraft, but no, these were not the familiar pentagrams and tetrahedrons and circles associated with sorcery. Rather, their opposite.
What is the opposite of sorcery?
I don't know.
Or the opposite of a pentagram.
The opposite of sorcery is just reality, right? Or something completely non-magical, like hearing August Derleth describe breasts. Maybe that's what it is, the opposite of sorcery.
He also says, up close, they were simply lines, no more. But from the middle of the attic, they had a strange kind of design, essentially other dimensional, I thought.
Mm.
What?
It makes sense to me. I don't know why you're questioning that.
Finally, he feels a strange feeling, like the attic seems to be holding its breath.
I like that.
So he gets freaked out, leaves the attic, Scooby-Doo style, just runs out of there. He calls the realtor right away, and he tells Adam, look, I don't know anything about a cleaning lady, like I said before. Maybe you should ask the neighbors.
Ask the neighbors. So this is the part in the horror story. It's investigation phase. Let's go gather information from the kooky neighbors.
So he goes over to one of the neighbors. It's an old man sitting on the porch, and he says that he's never really talked to Uriah when he was alive, but... When asked about the cleaning lady, he says, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. And the old guy says, well, I've never actually seen her leave or come into the house. I've only seen her through the windows at night.
While he was hiding in the bushes, I presume.
Yeah.
He then asks Adam if he's seen the bright blue light yet, to which Adam is like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, well, have you heard anything you couldn't explain? And then that kind of goes, well, okay, that has happened. The old guy says Uriah was up to something. Adam says, like, he's not up to anything. He's dead. And the old guy goes, well, you can't prove that to me. And he goes, wait, everybody saw the cops? People came? He goes, well, I saw a coffin leave the house, but I don't know what was in the coffin. Maybe it was a trick. You know, he's an evil wizard kind of guy. And at that point, Adam goes, this guy is full of beans. I'm not going to listen to him anymore.
But the old neighbor does leave him with, he did concede that, left alone, Uriah did not trouble the neighbors. And he had been left strictly alone ever since old Mrs. Barton had gone to his house and upbraided him for keeping a woman there, and was found dead of a heart attack next morning at her home. Scared to death, they said. So Uriah's killed even more people than just the narrator's family.
Yeah.
Anybody that crosses him.
And, of course, creepy Uncle Uriah has no shortage of scary books.
Yes, of course. Adam finds his uncle's library and then goes on to list all of the titles of the books, and they're spooky and they're hard to pronounce. You can take a crack at it if you want.
I don't.
Do we have them?
Yeah, yeah. Go for it.
Oh, yes, the Malleus Maleficarum, for example, and very old books by Olaus Magnus, Eunapius, De Rochas, and others. Few titles meant anything to me. I had never heard of Anania's De Natura Demonum, or De Vignate's Questio de Lamiis, or Stampa's Fuga Satanae.
Whoa.
Yeah. I never heard of those either. At least he's mixing it up. It's not von unaussprechlichen Kulten
something. Yeah, these are some new ones.
Some new crazy books.
That is crazy sight reading, Andrew.
So that very good. Yeah, awesome. That was he was no prep from Lehman there. That was awesome.
You have all those books in your library.
Don't
you?
Yeah.
So thumbing through the books and looking at the notes his uncle made, it seems Uriah was into this idea of the soul coming out of the body and then replacing that soul with another soul. Say a creepy old uncle putting the soul of himself into the body of a handsome young nephew. So Pfeiffer, if you were evil, how would you use this power?
The switch, like you can switch to another body?
Yeah.
I think I'd do the same thing. I'd wait till I was getting old and then switch into...
You're like your nephew?
No, I would not do somebody from my own family, I think. I mean, nothing against them. I just would want to switch it up a little bit. You know, I'd be like... be a Cuban drummer or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But I do the same thing, yeah. Try to stay young.
I think if I had this power, maybe you could switch, like get really old and then you switch bodies with a criminal, somebody that's like a bad person, and then you could make their life like a good, but then again, everybody would think you were the criminal that did all the bad stuff, and then you have to overcome all that, like, you know, a jail.
This is what weird fiction is all about, making those hard choices.
Yeah. It is. So Rhoda calls Adam from Boston and tells him that she's, you know, made some library use checks, possibly Cthulhu's Mythos check, by looking at some spooky books in the library there.
Yeah, the whole time he's been fishing around the house, she's been out doing the real research.
She tells him to get out of the house. There's a reason his uncle wanted him to stay there for 3 months, but Adam dismisses her and says, yeah, I'm fine.
And just throw a tidy little inheritance over my shoulder? Not a chance, Rhoda. There's some good dialogue here. Don't you see, Adam, that shadow in the attic? Some monstrous thing came in by way of that hole and blasted that shadow there, she said.
I've always said women simply aren't rational creatures.
Adam, this isn't a man-woman thing. I'm scared.
Come back. I'll protect you.
Resigned, she rang off.
If I was her, I would have told him to F off.
Yeah. This guy's a dunce. I, you know, reading both of these, it occurs to me now that she would have been better off with that fisherman from the first story. That guy knows how to take care of a lady.
True. So chapter 4 at night, while in bed, he sees the cleaning woman pass by his doorway. He gets up to check it out. She's downstairs cleaning, and he feels like he's being watched. So he turns around, and he sees what looks like the ghost of his uncle.
There, in the well of glowing darkness behind and a little above me, hung the spectral likeness of great-uncle Uriah Garrison, something as ephemeral as air, the heavy, bearded face distorted a little by the moonlight's iridescence, the burning eyes, the shock of tousled hair, the high bones of his cheeks with the parchment skin tight over them, seen for an instant so unmistakably. Then it collapsed like a pricked balloon and vanished, save for a thin serpentine coil or rope of some dark substance, which seemed to flow, writhing and turning, down the stairs to where I stood until it, too, disappeared like smoke.
So it's not just this strange masked housekeeper. The uncle is spectrally actually floating around here in the house as well.
Yeah, so after seeing his uncle vanish, Adam goes into the kitchen, sees the cleaning lady there. She turns to look at him. She's got that expressionless face and the creepy eyes. She's giving him the willies, and he knows that it was her boob that he felt the other night. He has breast intuition.
He does. And if you recall, he said in an earlier reading that when he was a child in the house, he had run across the woman, and it was an odd experience. And in this moment, he realizes, oh my gosh, this is the exact same woman, and she looks exactly the same. So she's been there for a very long time.
He wants to say something to her, but he can't. He just runs away up to his room, and he says that he thinks he knows what she is. For I knew what I had seen was something more than a woman, but I did not know what. Something in bondage to my uncle, something bound to return night after night and perform these rites. Where she came from remained unknown. Now, I'm thinking he's bound her to house cleaning?
Yeah.
Like she is like the, but what is she? Is she a demon? Is she a ghost? Is she a ghost of a witch? Is she a Migo or something? Migos don't have breasts.
You don't know that.
In the
you
canon.
Don't know that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's true. That. They don't actually explicitly say that they do have or don't have breasts. So
if you had never read The Whisper in Darkness, you might think that they did.
So when he finally gets the courage to go out, she's gone, she's not there anymore. But from under the attic door, there's a blue light that's fading. He opens up the door, and the blue light's coming out of the little mouse hole, and it's just gone. The mask and the clothes are there.
He touches the mask, and it's warm. So somebody's worn it recently, and then his match dies, and he's like, all right, I'm getting out of this.
Yeah, he runs to his bed and waits. Adam knows something is messing with him, but he can't really fight it.
He says he should leave like Rhoda asked, but he's reluctant. He says, not because of it was my inheritance, but for a frightening kind of bondage, almost kinship, that kept me there. So he's getting somewhat hypnotized at this point, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So this story really is kind of a cross between the case of Charles Dexter Ward and the thing on the doorstep, all wrapped up in a Dreams of the Witch House kind of package.
Yeah, I mean, given we did make up a story fragment that this might be based off of, but I really couldn't find an actual thing from a commonplace book or anything that this is based off of. So I think that he said, you know, maybe I'll base it off of three other stories that are way better than the one I'm writing right now. And then I can put Lovecraft's name on it. Maybe that's what was going on.
So Adam falls asleep and dreams.
I dreamed. Dreamed that the blue light burgeoned and mushroomed into the attic, came flowing down the stairs and into the room where I lay. And out of the mouse hole at the apex of the angle of roof and floor came to swell and grow the figures of the cleaning woman, now clad and rubber masked, now hideous with age, now naked and beautiful as a young woman, and beside her my great uncle Uriah Garrison, invading the house and the room, and at last me. A dream from which I woke bathed in perspiration on the edge of dawn, which lay pale blue in the room before it gave way to the roseate hue of the morning sky.
So he wakes up from that to a pounding door. He goes down and sees that it's Rhoda. She says he looks terrible and he says to her, we don't need you. And he says, we? He thinks to himself, why did I say we? That's weird.
So I'm too late then.
Go away, I said. Just leave us alone. So Rhoda pushes past him, grabs his dissertation work, and says, you won't need this. And he goes, well, I'm not going to need that. You can take it.
So she takes all of his actual work that he should be doing and says, goodbye, Adam. And then she just splits. And he should be upset, but he says, I was aware of a secret satisfaction at the way things were turning out. So his uncle is clearly influencing him at this point.
So chapter 5.
The final chapter.
The rest of the day, Adam is in a bit of a state, not really eating or drinking much. And night comes, and he understands that he has to go to his uncle's old bedroom. The hours pass by, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, and then the blue light comes. And so does the woman, whose name we now know is Lilith.
Yeah, he goes, her name's Lilith. It just like occurs to him that that's her name. And Lilith is a demon from Jewish mythology, sexually charged. I believe that the demon was said to steal babies. And of course, in some Jewish folklore, Lilith is the first wife of Adam. So I suddenly go, maybe that's why they named this character Adam in the story. Yeah. Mm. But I don't know if this is meant to be the actual Lilith or not.
Yeah,
it probably is. But then his uncle's ghost appears at that moment, starts moving toward him with his writhing serpentine coil that we heard about before when he appeared on the stairs, which I was thinking maybe is like a, you know, that's his connector to possess. It's like some kind of spectral, you know,
remote control
cord or something like that that he can get into the other body. But before the ghost and Lilith can get Adam, there's something more.
Something that filled me with sudden terror. I smelled smoke, and I heard the crackling of flames, and from outside came Rhoda's voice calling, "Adam! Adam!" The vision collapsed. The last thing I saw was the expression of terrible rage on my great-uncle's spectral face, the fury on the face of the woman changing in that light from that of a lissom girl to that of an ancient hag. Then I flung myself to the window and opened it. "Rhoda!" I cried. She had taken no chances. There was a ladder up against the windowsill. The house burned to the ground with everything in it.
Boom! Rhoda rocked it. She just saved the day. She came in. She burned the house down.
Yeah.
She had a ladder ready. She had it all planned out.
By the way, she had a ladder ready, which is nice, but she started burning it while he was in there. So she didn't like go in and wake him up.
No.
If he didn't come down the ladder, she'd have been like, oh well.
But she did her research. She knew he was under the spell and wouldn't come of his own free will, so she had to destroy the house.
Well, isn't that what happened in Mary Tyler Moore, too? Didn't Rhoda burn down WJM at the end?
Yeah. But that, it didn't happen with Rhoda. It happened with Ted Knight's character.
Oh, yeah. Ted Baxter, yeah.
Ted
burned the station down.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this story. She is awesome, but I love that she went and she figured everything out, and then her solution was totally low tech.
It's too bad that she wasn't in the story more, because that would have probably been a better story.
Oh, whatever.
All of what Rhoda did was off stage
because
while we're with Adam in the house.
That would have been fantastic, because I'm sure she went to Miskatonic and said, "How do I fight this?" And they said, "You do this spell, and then you try and do this thing, and then draw this." And she's like, "Screw it, I'm just going to blow that place up. I'm not dealing with it."
Yeah. But it turns out that she spent the day at Miskatonic going over the books on witchcraft and figure out what was going on.
By all in one afternoon, she did that.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Rhoda's the best.
Her theory is that Uncle Uriah possessed the house and was trying to take over Adam's body, and the woman was a succubus, maybe his mistress. The mouse hole was a gateway to another dimension.
It actually says the mouse hole was obviously an opening into another dimension. So, you know, I think Rhoda's kind of calling him a dummy as she explains this to him as well. How could you not know that?
So, if the housekeeper was a succubus, that is a sex demon, a literal sex demon.
Yeah.
Like, they want to have sex with you to get your life force or whatever. And this guy had it clean in his house?
Yeah. But remember, it said that when he had heard the screaming of a woman, it sounded like she was being punished. So I think it might be, he enslaved Lilith somehow.
Right.
And is punishing her and making her clean up his messes and stuff because it's because he wants her power, you know, kind of like that Sandman story with Calliope. It's that same kind of thing where he enslaves this mythical being.
But Rhoda, she figured it out and took care of business. And this is the end of the story.
Trust a woman to construe some kind of romantic angle out of even the most curious events. Succubus, indeed. There are times, even now, when her notions affect me. From time to time, I find myself unsure of my own identity. Am I Adam Duncan or Uriah Garrison? It does no good to mention it to Rhoda. I did so once, and she said only, "It seems to have improved you, Adam." Women are fundamentally not rational creatures. Nothing will shake her free of her notions about the house on Aylesbury Street. It annoys me that I find myself unable to come up with a more rational explanation myself, one that will satisfy all the questions that occur to me when I sit down and think about the events in which I played such a small, if motivating, part.
What a jerk.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah, that's the end of the story. You know,
I love that it ends with the suggestion that Adam may actually still have some crazy uncle floating around in there, and Rhoda is cool with it. She likes it, actually.
Well, that reminds me of the end of Young Frankenstein. Because you remember when he tries to do the brain transfer, it died.
Where he
got a little bit of the monster and he got to be a little bit better.
The other movie that I finally realized I was thinking of all through this was Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Because that's the only other one where a cleaning woman is the villain of the cleaning woman. You should never have a cleaning woman as the main character of a horror story, is my opinion.
Perhaps. Any remaining thoughts on these stories from either of you?
Yeah, they were a lot of fun as Derelith. I mean, not quite Seven Deadly Poes, but still very enjoyable reads. And maybe I'm a little hard on Derelith, but then I think
they're terrible.
They're certainly enjoyable reads, I'll say that. And so go out and pick up this book. We've just endorsed it, right?
don't
but
do that.
Hey, that's our show for today. I want to once again. I want to once again thank and remind folks to check out the fine publications at Fedogen and Bremer, yes. Available in the vendor hall. Also, if you come up here afterwards, we can sling some of those for you.
Yeah, the good stuff. We also want to thank Lyle Erickson for providing our music and our sound stuff. Great job.
Thank you to Heather Klinke for warming up the audience and for putting up with me all week.
I also want to thank Andrew Lehman for reading the crap out of this stuff. And you can see us all tonight, yeah, at Brotherhood of the Beast, this room, yep, 8 o'clock.
I think it's at 7:30.
7:30.
It's 7:30 a little bit of a longer episode than usual. It's because it's super length, and we're going to vote on the ending, so it might go till 9:30.
Last but not least, I want to thank this awesome audience today,
yes,
and everybody who supported us when we needed the cash to get out
thank
here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you, so
yeah,
thank
you're
you.
The best. So thank you so much. And I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Andrew Lehman.
And this has been the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, live from Providence. Thank you, everybody.
We gotta get out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, no, we have- Yes.